Lisa is an active live sound engineer, and she's working regularly at venues such as the Triple Door, Village Theater Kids Stage, the Highliners Musical Theater, Sound Theater Company, and Showtunes Theater Company. Some of Lisa's favorite work in the past has been work with Goblin Market, Les Miserables. Was that right? Les Miserables. The Bridges of Madison County. And in addition to her talent in live sound engineering, Lisa also works as an attorney. So without further ado, please welcome Lisa Vincral.
Talk to you tonight about line mixing for musical theater. First and foremost, a little bit about me. Who am I? So my undergrad degree is in music business. During undergrad is when I started doing live audio. I consider myself a professional audio engineer since 2006, and I've been sound designing for musical theater since 2012. There are some of the venues I've worked at. I started my career at the Hot House in Chicago. It was an international music venue. Rest in peace. I continue to work at the Triple Door. I've done work at the Crocodile, Teatro Sanzani, Village Theater, Cornish Playhouse, Eck Theater, the Erickson Theater at Seattle Central, 12th Avenue Arts, and a few others. I also toured with a local band called The Senate for over 2 years, which is also kind of my inspiration to go to law school. Working on this side of the industry, you see everything wrong with it, so I wanted to do something to try to help artists more. So I've been a licensed attorney for coming up on 5 years. I currently am in-house counsel for HTC. We make the Vive virtual reality headsets, if any of you are familiar with those.
What is HTC?
HTC, we are a cell phone manufacturer and we do virtual reality hardware. And then fun fact about me, I see on average a show a week. That does not count working that. The term line mixing, is that a familiar term for anyone, or is this a new concept? I guess if you're familiar, can I see hands? Okay. And then a new concept? Oh, it's about half and half. All right. Also, side note, if I move too fast or say something that doesn't make sense, or you have any questions, please interrupt me. I'm a lot more comfortable having a conversation rather than just blabbing for forever. I don't like the sound of my own voice all that much, so I would like to hear yours as well. So what is line mixing? It's a style of mixing where you throw faders for each line of dialogue in a play. You bring the fader up for the dialogue, take it out once the actor is done talking. So only the fader of the person actually talking is up during each line. You end up programming the show down to 8 DCAs, and then you use scenes to program. Yes?
Define your TLAs.
Yes. DCA is a... Oh, why am I blinking on the...
Digital
control
amplifier.
Thank you.
We know, but...
Yes, digital control amplifier. And you use this terminology all day, and you're like, oh, wait, what does that mean? So you program the show down to your 8 faders and usually have one master band fader. So you have independent control of your vocals versus your orchestra. You have 8 fingers, you have 8 DCAs. Some consoles have banks of 12 DCAs. The last show I worked on was with a Digico SD9. It had a bank of 12, so I used the extras for effects and ensemble microphones, things of that nature. I also wanted to mention, I'm also a glutton for punishment. I've worked for a couple of theater companies who use analog consoles still. I have thrown a show on an analog console, so that's between 12 and 24 faders. That involves a lot of forearm moves and a lot of really wide spans with your hands. It's not fun. I don't recommend it. I am a crazy person. And then on top of that, you have to follow the script the entire show. So you're going line by line with the actors, pretty much ignoring everything that's actually happening on stage and just following the script.
I have a question.
Yes?
Do you use a hard copy or do you use like an iPad or something for looking at the script?
I prefer a hard copy, mostly so that I can take notes on the fly and...
it doesn't crash.
I can highlight things. I can put stars next to lines that I continue to miss over and over and over again. I can turn pages over when there's a scene I need to rehearse. Call me old school. I like the tactile piece of it. So being in the script the entire show. So you have to consistently be looking 3 to 5 lines ahead. I tell the engineers I mentor that you always have to be 3 lines ahead of the actors on stage, or else you're already behind. Yes.
What's your interaction with the stage
manager? Stage manager is, since they take over the show opening night, they are kind of your liaison between you and the actors and everything that's happening on stage and backstage. Stage managers are God. That is basically how it boils down to.
Well, and in my experience, they're usually calling sound and light cues as well. I'm just wondering if your interaction with the person on the line there. Are they calling cues, or you just not going to tell me anything?
Both. So, some of the shows I work on, the console will have a cue light on it, so there are certain sound cues like a lightning flash or something like that, where the lights and sound need to go together. And those are the ones that the stage manager will actually cue to ensure that they're done together. If the sound cue is cued by a line or an action or something, usually during the tech process, we decide if it's something that I can do on my own or if the stage manager wants to do it. I'm totally flexible with whatever the stage manager wants to do. The issue being, if I'm line mixing a musical, my ears need to be in the show the entire time. I can't have a headset on. So it's just going back and forth. If I need to put a headset on, I'll put that in my script. Like, headset on for this line, headset off. Working that way. So this is generally how I label my book. And you can see here, at the top of the page, we've got 3, 1, 2, 3. So while 3 is singing, I'm thinking in my head, 1, 2, 3. When line 1 goes up, I'm thinking 2, 3, 5. When 2 is up, I'm thinking 3, 5, 6. And it just goes on and on and on through the entire show. If you're thinking about the line that's happening on stage while it's happening, you're already behind. It's like downloading a video on a slow internet connection. Your brain has to buffer and catch up, and then you can continue going forward. So this is actually the scene I'm going to show you. As long as audio is working. Play sound? Come on. Did you reset it?
Thank you.
Condenser mics on them, the guitar was direct in, and then the keyboards were direct. But the band is on stage with the actors. So show tunes does concert-style musicals. So actors are all books in hand. Orchestra's on stage with all of them. So I had somewhat limited control over them. The audience was still getting a lot of acoustic sound from the band, but using the sound system to supplement.
Well, I couldn't really tell, but it appeared as if you weren't doing too much action with those guys.
No, generally because your hands are so busy with actors, if I were to do any band moves or anything, I would either program them into the scene, or there were a couple of moments in that show where the violin had kind of a response line to the actor's melody line, and so I just reach over, bump that up, take it out, but I have this conversation with my directors and my music directors all the time. You run into the problem of, I don't have hands for that. You have a really busy scene, and they're like, oh, and we want these 5 sound effects, and we want these 3 band bumps, and I don't have 5 hands. So sometimes it's like, well, priority comes to being able to hear the actors over, you know, the French horn bump in the middle of the 3rd verse and things of that nature.
That's
also having camera issues?
So I'm assuming you're working with the music director and you're assuming that they are handling internal balances within their orchestra.
For the most part, I generally try to defer to their expertise since they've been working with, and I get into this later, but we can discuss it now. I'm totally happy having a conversation with y'all. The music director working directly with them, like they've been there since day one. They've been teaching the music, they've been rehearsing with the band members. And so I like to kind of leave the direction of orchestra to them, and I just present. I just amplify. There are certain instances where, you know, the trumpet player is blowing as hard as they can, and they just can't get over the piccolo, or, you know, whatever. Had that happened in Les Mis a couple summers ago. Our piccolo player was right by the opening for the conductor. And, got a console. So the piccolo player was right next to the opening for the conductor. So no, even if I took it out of the speakers entirely, still just shrilled through the house. And, you know, what can you do? You can't give negative audio to to something.
Piccolo mute, dark
mute. So you were asking about duets. So, you know, you have your lead actor, you have your duet partner, and they're going back and forth, singing back and forth. And then they turn and sing in each other's faces. So the next point I was going to talk about is why line mixing is a good idea. So in musical theater, most of the actors' mic placement is on their hairline, either under a wig, in their hair. If you have a character like Daddy Warbucks or someone else who doesn't have a whole lot on top, they go over the ear, but that's kind of the exception, not the rule. Generally, you put your omnidirectional Mickey 2 or your B3 right in your hairline. So when you have actors singing into each other's faces, you start getting phasing issues. And so the line mixing is a way to mitigate and prevent those phasing issues. But when you have, you know, the two lead love characters singing in each other's face, they go back and forth singing, and then when they start singing the duet together, usually you choose one of them. Usually during the tech process, you figure out whose mic sounds better, but you end up dropping one about halfway down, and sometimes even dropping it out entirely, depending on how close they are to each other, height differences, things of that nature. Don't normally phase switch, just because it impacts everything else.
Right.
Over the course of the show. Yes, you're going to ask.
If they're both using the same amount of microphone, what do you think one sound better than the other placement or other aspects?
Could be, if you have two actors that are relatively similar in height, then the sound is kind of coming into it at the same angle. If you have, a 6'4" and a 4'11" actor singing at each other, that'll really impact because it's not getting as much direct sound into the microphone. It's really just the directionality of all of it that will determine, you know, which is kind of the better mic to use in that situation.
Are the mics you're using, are they wireless? And if so, are they kind that is in front of the mouth, or what kind are you using?
Most of the theaters I work for use, I mean, almost kind of similar to this. They use lavaliers, but thread them up through their hair. So it's usually a Sennheiser Mickey 2, Country Mickey 3. I mean, those are the two most common ones. Some of the Broadway shows are using the really, really thin ones that go to the mic, but they're also very, very expensive. And yeah, the DPAs. Very expensive. I know Teatro Zanzani uses them. I believe Fifth Ave has used them before, but they're also not very durable. And like, I work a lot in youth theater. You don't want to put a DPA on a 15-year-old. Yeah. Unless you want to continue replacing that DPA, you don't put that on a 15-year-old. There's a question in the back.
Yeah. The rapid fire dialogue thing, I've heard some people talk about like programming two scenes and just toggle back and forth.
I've never done that. Mostly to avoid the, like, if you happen to be a half second late, avoid the kind of jarring, like, pick up in the middle of the line, which is why I like the fade in a little bit more, because it's a little, like, even if you're half a millisecond late, it's a lot easier for your ear to follow that. Yes, in the back.
I did all my mixing years ago. It was all done, that was because we didn't have any digital miking, but it's all done with the floor mics, like Mic Vice.
Shakespeare in the Parks, Windmill Theater, or Seattle Shakespeare Company in the Parks this summer.
They're still doing that. I generally advise against using floor mics or hanging mics to the theaters I work for, unless you're trying to use them as tap mics to pick up tap shoes. Mostly because floor and hanging mics tend to pick up everything you don't want them to pick up, especially if you have a live orchestra. You're going to get so much orchestra bleed that you're not going to be picking up the actor voices the way you want to.
You see a thing called Mic, Easy has a thing called Mic Mouse, with a styrofoam base, a foam shell, and you slip the mic into the center of, and the base is actually going to start picking up floor noise, so you can actually use it on a heavy dance show and stuff like that, and it would just take pretty much reflect voices into it.
Oh.
And pick up the tap dance and stuff like that.
Nice. Yeah. No, most theaters strap a microphone on every actor and go from there.
So,
they don't really know how to sing anymore.
Oh. We can have a beer and we can talk about that.
So, do you bring up to a default level for most of the dialogue? Because if you don't, I mean, do you undo any of the dynamics of the act? Performers are putting in their voice. I'm just curious what you do about that to avoid undoing somebody else's artistic use of dynamics.
Yeah, I try to just enhance what is already coming off the stage.
Well, I mean, since you need to try, what you want to do is you want to avoid what you're calling the phasing thing. It's kind of, if the heights are approximately the same and the actor's voice comes in about the same volume into both microphones, you will get a literally what we call a comb filter, and people do hear that. And then I went, oh, that's what she's trying to avoid. You know,
yeah.
But I just was wondering about, I've once mixed for a play, I didn't do very good, but it was my daughter's theater company thing, and that was just something that I was so worried about. And so sometimes I left
So some of the issues with that is, you know, every time you turn on another microphone, you increase the noise floor that you're getting off the microphones. Every time you turn on another microphone, you risk, getting background chatter and stuff from other actors. So
even if it was a two actor as actors in a dialogue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Still go back and forth.
Right.
Yeah.
I suppose they could bump the microphone or something if they're moving around.
If they're on their head?
Or whatever. They're not speaking.
Yeah. Oh, in the back.
Underestimated the expectations of the audiences today. That is really driving the multi mic. You listen to a play with area miking, we're all looking for the hyper real anymore. We're going to sound real, but a little more than real.
Background chatter. So actors like to talk. It's what they're paid to do. So the second they walk off stage, they chatter. If you have five actors on stage, one of them runs off to grab a prop and comes back on stage, you better duck their mic when they go off stage, because otherwise you're going to hear them tell the stage manager, like, oh, I screwed that up, or, oh, man, my new, you know, the new person I'm dating is in the second row. I'm so excited. Yes. You know, people do that all the time. You know, you get the rogue toilet flush. I was doing a show years ago. I had two actresses. They had dressing stations next to each other. They swapped their mics on accident. So the first actress is out on stage. I throw her mic for her line. I hear nothing. I take it out. I put my headphones on. Hear toilet flush. I was like, oh, all right. Listen to a little bit more and could hear the other actress chatting with people backstage. So get on calm, talk to the stage manager, like, hey, these two actresses swap mics. Can you, you know, when she walks off stage, can you swap them back so that we're good for the rest of the show? So it does happen.
Adapt and go to the other mic, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I have done that before on some shows where you can just repatch real quick and go on. This show, she was going off stage and going off for a long time, so I was just like, okay, just unscrew her element from her pack, swap the packs, put them back on their bodies. So we did kind of the low-tech swap.
I was, when I was serving ice cream, I was, I was at behind stage, backstage on a show, and there's always a person there that was monitoring the mic inputs, what they were, you know, I think they were looking at an iPad or whatever it was. But,
yeah, the backstage A2 that's,
right.
You know,
that's
monitoring
like
all the
person, and that person's watching every mic to make sure they're working and they're live.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That
would be the person you'd be communicating with generally.
If that person exists. A lot of the theaters I work for are smaller and don't have budget for that second person backstage.
Right.
So usually I'm talking to the assistant stage manager, sometimes even saying like, hey, can you grab the costumer?
Like a mic police type thing. Like watching every movie, but they're really careful about it.
Yeah. Having an experienced A2 on a show is such a gift. Yeah.
It's part of your job wiring up the stage. Putting the mics on them, doing all that check stuff.
Yep, you know, wiring up the orchestra, doing all the after sound checks during, you know, very first tech. So when I'm setting the levels, I'll get to a little bit kind of stylistically what I tend to do with that. But yeah, generally.
You don't just show up and mix.
No, unfortunately, that would be the dream. Unfortunately, no. Yes.
You do this on your feet all night, or do you sit?
I like to stand when I do it. Keeps me more alert, keeps me more in the show. I find if I sit, I start getting tired and get kind of lazy, so I like to stand and be in the show the whole time. Some theaters I work for, like Cornish, their desk is really tall, and I'm not that tall, so I kind of have to stand in order to do it. If I sit down, I'd be mixing like this. That's not fun for anybody. Okay, so.
Well, what's the average length show?
Average length show is anywhere between 2 and 3 hours. It's usually like an hour, hour and a half first act, 15-minute intermission, like hour second act.
Well, this is similar to what we had at the Fifth Ave, and same deal.
Yeah. Let's see, where was I? Okay, so. Talked about noise floor reduction, because when you get all of those actors on stage, you know, mics are noisy. You start just compounding that on top of each other, and you get kind of this airy, messy mix, and you can't understand anything anybody's saying. So overall, you're looking for a cleaner mix. I worked with a student engineer once who did what I call lazy mixing, where he would pop like all the faders that are already on stage up to about minus 20, and then just pop the lines. And I kept, because I was mentoring him, he was a student, I was like, you need to actually throw the show. And he's like, well, I'm so afraid I'm going to miss something. I'm like, well, then miss it, learn from your mistake, and do it right the next time. But he was trained with his high school theater, where, you know, high schoolers don't necessarily follow the script like they're supposed to. They jump lines, they do all these things, and he was so afraid that these actors were going to jump lines on him or skip over things and everything, that he's like, well, I'm just going to be prepared for everything. I was like, that's not your job. You know, these actors need to learn to do their job well so that you can do your job well. Like, they need to realize that their actions have downstream consequences and they impact everybody else working on the show.
It doesn't look like there's much room for improvisation with your
Yeah, not really. And for actors, as kind of loose and free as they are in their personal lives, when they're on stage, they are regimented. They are, I stand here, I say this line, I look over here, I do this. They do it the same way every single night. So it's really easy to kind of learn the show, even memorize parts of the show because they do it so consistently. Yeah. I have one actor I've worked with who consistently gets louder over the course of a run. You start the show at one level, you set all your levels, you set all your programming and everything, and then a week later he's 5 decibels louder. And then a week later he's 7 more decibels louder. And he just keeps changing and changing and changing. It drives me nuts. But it's usually when I go to the stage manager and I'm like, hey, I'm having issues with this, it's making my job harder. Can you talk to him about consistency and doing the show that we have rehearsed and that the director has instructed him to do? Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but you always have to be able to adapt on the fly, too. Okay, so how do you set up your board to do this? I know for some of you who are experienced in this, you probably do this way differently than I do. The biggest thing is building your magic scene. That's what I call the base scene that I built. Getting all your safes in, getting all your levels all dialed in, sending, routing everything the way you're supposed to do. Ultimately depends on the console and your sound system setup. When I have control over it, I usually send all my vocals to a mix, send that mix to a matrix, assign the matrices to speakers. So that way I'm able to send everything post-fader to the mix, goes to the matrix, I have independent control of my band, everything is happy. You also need to make sure that all your mutes are saved so that they don't carry from scene to scene, or else you're going to have rogue microphones coming through your speakers the way that is set up. It can just impact your frustration levels when building and checking your show. I can't tell you how many times I have forgotten to save something at the very beginning, programmed the entire show, hit scene go, and then all of my vocals dropped out of my band monitors, or something to that, because I didn't have something set from the beginning, and I have to go through and put all the mics in the mix, go next, put it in, save, next. Yeah. Yes.
So in line with what you're just saying, how often do you use your own console for some of these shows, and how often do you have to get up and running on a completely different console for your show?
So a lot of the theater companies I work for use some of the same equipment. I work for a lot of smaller, lower-budget theaters, so they're usually running, like, the Behringer X32. Village uses an M7 for their main stage, so I'm really familiar on that. The Digico that I used at Cornish, that was new to me, so learning that. Also, with show tunes, they do a 2-day tech process. So loading in, programming the show, learning the console, getting everything up and running in 2 days is really difficult. I had their house engineer helping me during loading and that first day of tech, so that was immensely helpful. But like I said, a lot of the theaters use the same equipment, or if they don't have their own equipment, I have a friend that I rent from, and he has an X32. X32s aren't perfect, but they're good for low budget theaters, and I worked on it long enough that I've come to an understanding with it. We don't like each other, but we deal with each other. So that's generally how I try to set things up. I try to do things somewhat the same each time so that I'm not trying to relearn. Except I inevitably forget something from show to show. I end up spending 10 minutes going through the menu, like, where was that thing? And yeah, just part of life. So like I said, you want to ensure independent control of band versus vocals because you don't want to turn down your master fader and lose all of your vocal gain. Safes, mutes, and effects, talked about those. And then book programming. So I go back and forth on whether I like to label and program in my book before putting it in the console. Ultimately, I find that it gets me about 80% there, but something will end up happening during tech where I need to reprogram a scene. Like the scene change is in the middle of 2 really fast lines and I just can't do it. Something inevitably ends up happening and setting me back. So So anymore, I kind of default to, I'd rather do it all at the same time. Just save time and stress and mental energy. And then, I don't know if you noticed in the video, the last thing I do before the show goes up is I label my faders. I always label faders 3 and 6, because in a bank of 8, you can find 1 and 8 by being on the outside. And then if you label 3 and 6, you can find all the other faders in relation to them. So, just a weird little trick I've come up with. So, labeling your book. Color coding is your friend. I had an engineer I worked with once, like you saw I use numbers. She wanted to use colors. She labeled all of her faders with colors and labeled all of her, all of the acronyms with colors and wanted to throw that way. It's like, cool, works for you? Have at it. But I always color code things like reverb in, outs, band level changes, sound effects, whether they're cued by a stage manager or I take them on my own. I have different color codes for that. I encourage all of that because you don't have a lot of time to think about what your notes mean. It's like, oh, pink, that means reverb on. You know, yellow, oh, that means band boost. You know, things like that. Let me say that's not fixed. Oh, I just talked about that. Okay, and then incidentals. So offstage lines, shouted lines you continually miss. You know, putting arrows next to them, putting stars next to them, you know, Sharpies, doodles, whatever, to call them out to make sure you see them. So, again, examples of how I label the board. Like you can see here, I have a verb out up in the corner that I cut off, and then numbers. This is a scene change. Yeah, you have all of that. The number down here is because this is on a page turn, so I know what the next fader I need to throw is while I'm turning the page. Yes?
So what kinds of things determine need for a new scene?
For me, I think I'm getting to that next. So the way I program, I'll go ahead and skip ahead because we've been kind of jumping around all night. So I do 1 through 8 in the scene. When I run out of faders, I go to a next scene. Or if it makes sense to change scenes based upon what's happening in the script. So I guess I'll go ahead and switch over.
I had a question.
Yeah.
Oh, about real quick.
I was going to show for labeling your book.
My bad.
If any of you are familiar with Q2Q Comics, it's one of my favorites. It's made by a sound engineer for a theater, and it stars all sorts of everybody you meet in a theater. So this is him continuously missing a line. So, don't miss it, Dingus. Wait, got it? So, okay, going into programming styles.
Are there any points in time where people have to wait for you to give a cue for when to proceed, like they're waiting for you to change the scene?
Usually just having to do with sound effects, like waiting for a phone ring or waiting for a doorbell or something like that. And so I've definitely had the shows where I'm thinking ahead of my script and I can hear it silent. It's like, oh, who's missing a line? Who's screwing up? And I realize, oh, it's me! Go. Okay, so programming styles. So I generally do, you know, the first, my muscle memory, I guess backing up, is if I hit a scene, go, to advance the scene, I immediately want to throw fader one. It's just the way I was trained, the way my muscles work now, it's just what I do. So I immediately go, one, and so the second person in the scene is 2, third person in the scene is 3, going on and so forth. With limited exception, there are some times that, you know, later in the scene there's a duet between 2 people, and so I don't want to be throwing like 1 and 7. So I may reconfigure my programming based on what is logical later in the scene.
Does that mean you do multiples for those? Like you do a multiple, like where 1 and 9? You know what I mean?
Generally, no. I will either just adjust my programming so that maybe instead of throwing one at the top of the scene, I throw eight, so that seven and eight are next to each other for the duet later. Or I'll change scenes earlier so that, you know, seven, and then they can become one and two singing. I know some engineers who, they will start at four and five and then move out, so they have their left hand working one through four, right hand on five through eight, so they're always just going next to the fader. I find that really difficult just because A, muscle memory, and B, trying to find what the next line is. I engineered a show that another engineer had programmed a couple years ago. She ended up with a conflict, and I stepped in kind of like final dress, I want to say. And she had programmed a scene where, you know, you had people talking, go, and then it just kept going. So you would just keep going, and my brain always just wanted to do go, one. And every single show, I should have just reprogrammed the scene just to make it easier for myself. I didn't. I was like, oh no, she did this. This is the way she wants that I should do her show. And didn't think about how it impacted me to run a show I was uncomfortable with. Other things to consider. So I do minus five and zero. So minus five for dialogue, zero for singing. I know other engineers would do minus 10 for dialogue, minus five for singing. Oh, do you have a question, Bill? Okay. Other people do minus 20, minus 10. Pros and cons for all of this. Me, again, it's muscle memory. I'm just used to doing five and zero because that's how I was trained. However, one of the risks to that is if you're really pushing somebody, you eventually run out of fader. If you have 10 as your vocal or as your singing level, you can push it a lot further. Also better for engineers with small hands. I have tiny hands, and yet I still throw far just like anything. It can also be a speed thing, so you don't have as far to go. Again, I'm a glutton for punishment and just do what is comfortable for me. Yes?
Are you pushing the singing harder than the speaking because with the singing you're trying to come up over the band?
Yes. Generally when there's dialogue, you don't have the underlying band unless there's underscore. And then at that point, you may go into kind of an in-between level, if that makes sense. Can I think what else? Oh, yeah. So I recently worked with an engineer who also, who had programmed the entire show down to DCAs, but also muted all the DCAs. So the scene would come up, and the faders would be all where they needed to be for the first line, but they would all be muted. So you had to unmute and then drop them when the line was over. I feel like that's kind of a carryover from the analog days when you were doing everything with mutes. For me, I'm like, don't give me an extra thing to do. Just bring the fader up, bring it down. Don't make me hit buttons too. But it's what worked for him. It was how he was comfortable. So it's not broken, we'll fix it. And then I also had gates here, and we talked about gates. Yes.
Is there a better recording of your mix while you have a show running and listen to it later to see actually what it really sounds like?
I have done that, or
you're kind of shocking sometimes.
Yeah. Sometimes during like Bumble Probe or during Final Dress, I may have like my production manager in the house take a video or take a recording or something so that I can kind of double check myself. Anymore, I prefer to do shows where I'm the designer and I have a separate engineer so that I can actually run around the house and design while I have somebody else throwing the faders. At the bare minimum, I like doing that for Model Probe, so the first rehearsal where you have band and singers all together, so that I can run around being a designer while I have somebody else just running the show.
I heard the word Model Probe.
Yes, so...
Did I say it right?
Vondel Probe.
V? With a V?
No, with a W. It's German.
Okay, good. I was way behind. I still am.
Okay.
Can you just describe what
that is? Yeah. So, sorry, theater terms that come naturally to me. So, in the musical theater process, you have two rehearsals where it's just actors and band. You have a sits probe and you have a Vondel Probe. So, a sits probe is where you sit and sing, and the orchestra, it's the first time the orchestra and the singers all hear each other. Bombal Probe is the first time actors are on stage.
Is that
and
wandering? Is that
yes, you? It's Bombal. You Bombal. So it's not. That's the description I have. So actors are usually doing their blocking, maybe not full out choreography, but they're at least moving around the positions of the stage so that they can hear how it's different from the monitors coming down to them. I can hear, if I'm getting dropouts on stage, things like that. Yes.
So if I understand right, when you talk about Burger and the Board,
mm-hmm.
Generally theater one is for the first actor who's speaking the scene,
mm-hmm.
two is for the second. So when you give an actor's mic, maybe jumping around the board.
Right. So on a console where you have, maybe 24 inputs and then you have the 8 DCAs that I've been talking about, so you just program them down to the DCAs and then change scenes, which reshuffles them within
right.
the DCAs.
Right. So you get to the end of the scene, you bump it to the next scene,
mm-hmm.
and then you go from there. I'm
mm-hmm.
wondering if, are you watching the show? Is there any dissonance between that physical fader and the actor that you're seeing on stage? Or are you just entirely visually focused on the book and just listening to the show?
I'm pretty much entirely in the book. I did have, I was going to mention, one show I worked on when I did Jesus Christ Superstar a few years ago. It was another show where somebody else programmed this show and I came in halfway through. And the way this engineer programmed it was that Judas was always on one, Jesus was always on two. So, it was kind of your panic button. Like, if you didn't know what to do, at least Judas is on one, Jesus is on two. But I would have the... right? I would have the muscle memory issue of a go one, and there were a couple of times that I missed, Jesus would be the first person talking at the top of the scene, and I'd throw one, he'd start singing, and move it over. If you're ever in the booth with me during the show, there's a lot of swearing. Just part of
the
business.
Assembly language.
Yes. Again, like I said, I do a lot of youth theater, so I mentor a lot of high school, junior high students, and usually about the second, the third time I drop the F-bomb, I'm like, I'm so sorry. But they have to learn, I guess.
They probably heard it.
Yeah,
they
probably
heard
it.
They have a
fucking thumb. Yeah. So just to add on this question, so just so I understand the picture of the program,
mm-hmm.
you have all your inputs, those are pretty much static throughout the show.
Mm-hmm.
Just the DCAs and what the assignments are of those inputs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes,
and are you working close to a glass, or are you usually
in the house? No, I'm usually in the house. I've done shows in the booth. For one of the companies I work for, the Highliners, they perform at Highline High School, and their sound booth is up, way up high in the booth. It's above the speakers, it's above everything, you can't hear anything in there. And the very first show I did with them, I did from up there. And I was miserable because I had no clue what my show sounded like. So from then on, I've been in the back row of seats, just set up back there and going. Yes.
For back center or back to the side?
Depends on the house. Obviously, I would prefer to be back center, just because I can get the best stereo field that way. But depending on how ticket sales are doing and everything, sometimes I end up kind of off to the side or in the corner. They have to make money so they can pay me, so I want them to sell seats. And if putting me in the corner means that they can sell 5 more seats, more power to them. Anything else for the moment? Okay, then I'm going to move back over here. We'll talk about sound issues and how to hopefully mitigate some of them. So, the line mixing sound engineers personal demise missed and late pickups. It's inevitable, happens to everybody. I at least have one every show. I'm also my own worst critic. I have thrown one perfect show my entire career. And that's my own judgment. Everybody else is like, oh, it sounded great. I'm like, no, I was late on that one pickup in scene three, and you didn't even notice. I tell my engineers that they get 10 shows to get it as close to right as they can. A lot of runs I do, you don't get 10 shows. Like Spitfire Girl that I showed you before, I got 4 performances. I threw the show a total of 6 times over the entire process. I was kind of sight reading the show the whole time. It's really difficult. It's not for the faint of heart. Basically sight reading the entire show. So like when you sight read a piece of music, when you see it for the first time and play it for the first time.
Reading from your notes.
Yeah, reading from your notes, just...
Okay, so you are following your program or anything else that you've already jotted down,
mm-hmm.
but you're just doing it pretty much on the fly. You've never seen it before, or you didn't have the opportunity to practice.
Right. Yeah, like no familiarity with the show, no familiarity with the script itself, just going by my numbers.
Is that typical in terms of tech time? Are you getting there before
no.
tech at all?
So most theaters will do anywhere from 7 to 10 days of 10 to 12 hour days for tech. You know, Village Fifth, even Village's youth program gets that. The company I most recently worked for, ShowTunes, since they do concert versions and they're strapped with budget and with staffing and all of these, they load in 2 days before opening. So, not common. It is unique to this one particular theater. Most other companies I work for, you get about 3 or 4 dress rehearsals, plus an entire QDQ process, where you go through the show, and they're setting lights, and they're running quick changes, and adding props, and everything else. So you get a lot of time to learn while you're holding for lights. Miss Lake pickups. Basically, you just kind of pick it up when you can, is the best thing. Actors skip lines. This is inevitable, out of your control, but this is why you always stay 3 lines ahead of where you are in the script. So that if they skip 2 lines, you're already on that 3rd line. It may take you a little bit to catch up, but you can always just get the fader up, catch up in your brain, and then go back to throwing. Actors talking when they shouldn't be. Youth theater, and especially like large musicals, you have actors that are off stage singing background vocals, either around an offstage singing mic or just in the wings on their body microphones, something. Inevitably, somebody is talking when they're not supposed to be. So I like to call them out, and my directors and my stage managers like when we call them out to be like, hey, Steve, you are talking, you were talking while everybody else was ooing. Things like that. So I tell my actors all the time I can hear everything they do backstage because I have headphones, and I can go through and solo and hear anything that's going on. I usually don't have time to do that. But I had an actor sit in the booth with me one show, and he's like, is it true that you can hear us? I was like, here are my headphones. Here, look, there's that actor. And he just, his eyes, he's like, oh my God. He's like, yeah, don't say anything you don't want me to hear. So if I hear talking when everybody else is singing, headphones, solo through, or I look at the LCDs on the channel and I can see which one is not balancing with everybody else, and let the stage manager know, like, hey, so-and-so is talking backstage, tell them to actually sing their part that they're supposed to be doing.
Yeah, does what you just said, does that apply to everybody on stage? In other words, if any actor, singer, whatever,
mm-hmm.
improvises, that would be a no-no?
Well, if they're not supposed to be in the scene, and they're off stage, then their mic is muted and they're not in. If they're supposed to be singing or supposed to be in the scene and they are not, once you throw their microphone up, all bets are off. What was it? Friends and Family, for a show It was Anna Green Gables at Village. The woman playing the matriarch, whose name I'm forgetting, she missed her entrance. And sound engineer threw her microphone. You can hear the stage manager backstage at her dressing station being like, hey, you need to be on stage. And then you hear her go, oh, shit. And then the fader goes out. So she comes out, does her scene. When you're in the book the whole time, your actors have to be on. And then I just kind of added this in your panic button. I try to program myself panic buttons anytime I can. Usually for me, that's always putting my ensemble on fader 7 and 8. So that if something happens in the middle of a big song, at least I have my backup singers. I can throw them up, figure out what's going on elsewhere. Or if something is going wrong and I'm trying to troubleshoot something mid-show on the fly, throw up my background singers, get on comms, say, hey, so-and-so's mic is broken, so-and-so's mic isn't working. So at least everything is still coming through the sound system, even if I can't physically be actively on the faders. Production team relations. So I talked to a friend of mine who is a director. As I was prepping for this, I'm like, hey, if you were going to a presentation on this, what would you want to know? He's like, I want to know whose opinion matters in the room. So, talking about getting input from other team members. So we already talked about your music director. So your music director is, they're teaching music from beginning to end. You should be walking hand in hand with them through the entire tech process. They know how the show is supposed to sound because they've been hearing it for weeks from the actors. They have very good ears, so they have a good opinion. Yes.
Sorry, are you sort of mixing music director and music supervisor in the same breath, or is that just a budget thing? Like,
probably a budget thing.
The director is usually the piano guy that's sort of running the band.
So it depends on the theater company. Most, I know Village, they have a music supervisor who is also a music director on certain shows. So he's not always available to be in the house with you, but if he is, I would go to Tim and be like, hey, can you be a second set of ears in the house for me while I'm doing this? Anything else I was going to say about this? They can also help you troubleshoot when you have an actor who's not blending into the mix. I have music directors who come to me and they say, okay, pull this actor out of this song, pull this actor out of this song. I was doing a production of Shrek years ago, and if you're familiar with the show, there's a song where, there's a passage of time. Princess Fiona does a trio with herself as a child, as a teenager, and as an adult. So our child Fiona could not keep her harmonies. For the life of her, music director was working with her, could not keep her harmonies. So he comes to me during rehearsal one night. He's like, so, we're going to pull her out of the mix. I was like, okay, well then who's going to sing her part? He's like, her older sister is going to be in the orchestra pit singing her part. So I programmed her mic into the scene. Young Fiona sings her solo. They start going into harmony. Take her mic out, put up her sister's mic. That happens more often than actors know, and she had no idea. She had no clue. The only people that knew were me, the music director, the actual director, the stage manager, and the sister. That was it.
Did the audience hear the young person good, sing?
No, she was far enough upstage and on a set piece. She was far enough away that her voice didn't carry. You were mostly hearing what was coming out of the speakers. Yes. Oh, is your hand not up? Okay, you're just relaxing.
How could she not know?
She was nine. She was nine. She didn't know because she's nine.
It's the written group.
Sorry. Yeah. Right. Even the adult actors I've worked with, and the music director comes up to me and says, hey, actor X, like, don't put him in this ensemble for an amount.
No, the thing is, if you're proud of, if the actor's far enough upstage, their voice a lot of being swallowed by the flies, so mm-hmm. and they don't have any, there's no reverberation coming back from the house.
Right.
They don't really know when they're on stage whether what they really sound like to the audience. That's what they depend on the mixer to the panel and stuff.
Yeah.
If you have to duck them out, then and replace them or do something, then they really don't know unless somebody from a family member shows up and goes, I couldn't hear you on that song.
Right. You are alone in the universe,
yeah.
Pretty much.
You've got all the curtains and the rest of the stuff up there that are just absorbed with all get out.
Mm-hmm. And the stage fullbacks, the stage monitors don't have vocals in them anyway, so you're hearing the orchestra, you're singing, you may be able to hear the person standing next to you, but you're not hearing your mic coming back. So, next one, director. So directors have a tendency not to think about sound at all when they are staging a show. You know, sound usually comes in about, you know, during the tech process, maybe a week before show's already staged, the lines are already handed out. Again, I work in youth theater. When you have a cast of 50 actors and you only have like 15 part, like named characters in the show, directors like to find opportunities to give more actors their moment in the spotlight. So they'll give out solos to somebody in the ensemble. They'll give out, you know, townsperson number three lines, things like that, which I am all for. You know, it's an educational program. You want to give these kids opportunities. Great. However, it comes back and becomes my problem when I have a limited amount of mics and I don't want to be swapping every 30 seconds. Last summer I was doing a production of Into the Woods. So one of the characters in Into the Woods is a narrator. Our director split up the narrator lines between 15 different actors. I had 22 microphones. So when I got this about a week before we went to tech, I went to her and I was like, I physically cannot do this. And she's like, oh, well, they're staged all over the stage. We gotta figure something else out. I'm like, no, like, it is not possible for us to mic every single one of them. So she went back, adjusted her staging so that any narrator that did not have a microphone was standing next to one who did. So I could throw the actor wearing the microphone, they would speak into each other's faces or kind of, you know, into each other so you could actually hear them. But happens in my world a lot. And I'll show you, I have a slide later that's an example of a mic plot that I've made for a show, so you can see who's wearing what microphone and what scene and when they swap and who they swap with and how they swap and everything, which can get very complicated when you have, you know, 45 actors in a show. So next one being stage manager. So the stage manager ultimately has the final say in safety, all things line changes and cuts, because they're usually keeping the master script. Also, it's who you give notes to the actors to. A general rule in theater is actors should only get notes from the stage manager. They don't need to be getting notes from everybody around, because they don't know who to listen to. If they all come directly from the stage manager, then they might actually do what you tell them to do. Other designers, so costumes, props, lights, sets, etc. Costumes you want to make good friends with, because they're usually making your mic belts. People like to come to me and ask for mic belts, and I say mic belts don't make noise, so they're not my world. But you need to, and I also don't own a sewing machine and don't have supplies and things like that to be able to make them. So making friends with costumes and wigs, and they're also the ones to work with you on placement under costumes, placement under wigs, you know, helping actors get mics in their hair, things like that. They're good friends, but they don't really have a say in actually how it sounds. Also, hats are the devil when it comes to theater. I hate hats. yes?
Sort of fully costumes, like wedding dresses and stuff like that. You make so much noise.
because that is just reality. I had an actor that had an, it wasn't a DPA, it was the Sennheiser version of it. I don't remember what it was. This was 8 years ago or so. He was wearing earrings, and I kept hearing this clicking noise in the microphone. Like, what is going on? There's the earring hitting the mic the entire time, every time he moved. And so went back to intermission. I was like, so can you do anything about that? He's like, I can take him out. I'm like, great, take him out. Okay, so I have another Q2Q comic about working with directors. I have this conversation every single show I work on. No, does the microphone have to be on their forehead? Yes. Can we move it to their ear? Well, you can move it to the ear, but you're sacrificing sound quality for aesthetics, and yeah. Yes. I've worked for, their artistic director was losing his hearing. So we started putting up a little hotspot for him on his table so that he wasn't, so it was coming straight at him, so he was no longer yelling about, like, can't hear it, turn it up, where's this, where's that line, blah, 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 like, it's right in front of you. I mean, deception is part of our job, too. So, then here I just have an example of a mic plot. This is for a production of Hairspray I did a couple years ago. This is Act 2. So you can see, you know, the actors who kept their mics the entire show, and then the actors who had to swap. Everything's color-coded. Every mic change is called out. Usually post this backstage, give it to the stage manager, email it out to the cast, you know, attach it to their forehead so they don't miss it. Anything. So, yeah. And then, any final questions?
Yeah.
Anything else? Yeah.
You mentioned sound design earlier. I'm curious what that for the actual
product. Yeah, so sound designer is different from your actual show engineer. The designer has final say on how everything sounds, usually works with all of the balance of the orchestra and the singers. You are creating or finding sound effects. You are, potentially building soundscapes for different scenes, maybe making sound effects directional depending on what the scene calls for, ultimately having the final say in how a show sounds.
I don't know if this is a low budget, high budget thing. I was curious about this, and obviously it would be up to the mixer to choose whether to use this or not. But do you know of mixers that either will use compression in specific mics, or will they use compression in the secondary phase of the system? So it's kind of limiting the whole output, you know, of your throw.
Yeah. I usually do compressors on individual singers, just because not everyone will have the same peaks and valleys.
And no limiting on the overall?
Generally, no. Usually when I'm sound checking actors, I have them give me dialogue, give me singing, and then give me like any shouty, belty stuff they have, and then set my compressor just so that it kicks in right at the peak. Yes.
To answer your question, I think it depends on where the engineer is
as far as I know, is not taught in any schools. It's taught entirely on the job. So if you want to learn this, you have to find an engineer who will teach you, or a theater who will hire you and teach you on the job. Cornish, I believe, just started teaching this on their last show, and has done it intermittently here and there, but you know, there isn't an actual like line mixing for musical theater course you can take in any school or university that I'm aware of. If there is a program, I would love to know where it is so I could go like take it as an adjunct.
North Carolina probably does.
North Carolina? Program. I don't know if it's in audio. I want to say it's a lot more in rigging and carpentry. Programs are a lot more focused on straight plays,
right.
and designing for plays versus musical theater, because they're two totally different monsters.
I know that Arlington High School does some.
Yeah. So, all the houses on Broadway use this technique. All the big houses in the city use this technique. Village did, Rep, everywhere else. I learned on the job at Village. Other theaters are kind of using their own techniques. They're doing the lazy mixing that I said, where you put all the theaters up and then pop them. They're doing other techniques that are not this, but I have had the experience in my career that when I am hired by a new theater and I bring this skill to them, I always have work. And I tell my engineers that I mentor and that I train, if you know this and you bring this into a theater who has never had it before, you will always have work. So it's valuable, and it can increase the quality of a show exponentially. And
it just keeps a sound that even people who maybe not be sound familiar eventually say, hey, this is substantially better.
Yeah. The first time I did a show with highliners and brought like line mixing to them, I had one girl tell me that her grandma said it was the first show she could ever understand the words for that she was in. So
growing up as a stage hand union kid, now I have a 14-year-old daughter who's going to be going to high school downtown.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really trying to nurture towards the whole arena of stage hand opportunities. I want to know what got you interested in line mixing, because that seems like a crazy thing to want to do.
Yeah. I got started in jazz, rock bands. The venue I worked at in Chicago was an international music venue. So I was doing African music and Brazilian music and everything. When I moved here, started working at the Triple Door, was doing much the same. But when I started working for the band, one of their best friends was a stage manager, and she introduced me to a couple of the audio engineers that she had worked with before, and it just kind of became this like, oh you have a show, oh you have work, I want work, and just kind of boiled in that way. I got my position at Village because the sound engineer there was leaving to go to Seattle Children's, and he was looking for somebody to take over his position. He knew I was an audio engineer, and he's like, oh yeah, you can totally learn this. I'm going to recommend you for this job. They took a chance on me, hired me, and I learned this, and now I do it all over the city. So your 14-year-old daughter, I guess I'll present this to everybody. I have a show coming up in September that I need a board op for. If anybody wants to learn this, come talk to me afterwards. Or if your daughter is interested, it's a great learning opportunity. Yes.
This was fantastic. It was something that I never imagined before. I didn't even know before today. And I've been around a bit. And so thank you. I'm not trying to stop it, but thank you so much for showing this tonight. It was another outstanding meeting.
You're welcome.
Here, here.
Doing this now, when I do rock bands or jazz bands, I'm bored because my hands aren't as active. I don't have to be in the show anymore. Yes.
Do you have a favorite show?
Favorite show that I've run, or a dream show that I want to run? Favorite show I've run. Jesus Christ Superstar was pretty fun. I also got the best compliment of my career doing that show. So Village has two locations, Issaquah and Everett. I was the master sound engineer in Everett. So the show starts in Issaquah. The Everett engineer takes it over and takes it up to Everett. So when I had come in and taken over the show, the director, Brian Yorkie, was there seeing the show. He wrote Next to Normal. He did Freaky Friday and 13 Reasons Why on Netflix and all this stuff. He came up to me at intermission. He goes, you throw me a show, where do we find you? And I was like, oh, I'm the Everett engineer. He's like, keep it up. So it was great. It was really reaffirming in that. But that show was just fun because I'd be throwing the show, but I'd be dancing the entire time. It's just a fun show. I think, in all honesty, the shows where I can relax enough to actually enjoy the show are the best ones. But that one was a favorite just because it was so easy to dance along to.
That follow-up to his dream show.
Dream show?
Yeah.
I'm getting to, well, I hopefully should be getting to do one this fall. I'm doing Light in the Piazza, which is why I need a board op on one show. And then Sunday in the Park with George is the other one I'd either want to be in or design for. Haven't decided yet. Anything else?
Probably one side.
Yeah, one more, yeah.
I know that on Broadway sometimes they do this for the ISO somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And report them to say, hey, you know, step it up. Have you ever been in that position where you had to deal with that?
I have not.
Yeah. That's a tough
one. I know. Having those conversations are never fun.
This is how you sound.
Is this how you intend to do this?
Alright,
any final questions? Awesome, thank you all for your time and attention. I really appreciate it.
Thanks everybody for being here.